Can I welcome you all for the first speaker of tonight, Mr. Craig Murray. And Craig, if you don't know, was a former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan. He was a whistleblower and a man of conscience and deep conviction. Craig Murray, ladies and gentlemen.
It's wonderful to see you all here to support Julian, to see so many of you again. Some of you, I'm quite sure. I left Woolwich Crown Court in a car to get here about 45 minutes ago. Not quite sure. I saw some of you standing outside. And how on earth you got here before me, I have no idea. But, plainly, the odd TARDIS was involved. But you know, you've made it, and well done. Those of you who've been there know how horrible and how dispiriting it is. I feel very tired just after a couple of days of attending that court. It's oppressive. It's extremely deliberately unpleasant. It's extraordinarily restrictive. You have a trial that is of interest to the world, and it's deliberately put where the world can't see it. You have a mainstream media that turns up to report it and then doesn't report it. And notably, yesterday, the BBC, The Guardian, ITN, Sky, they were all there yesterday for the prosecution statement. They all left after the prosecution statement. And today was, of course, the opening of the defence, so none of them were there at all, because they have no interest in the defence. All they were interested in doing was putting the government case and using it further to smear Julian. It is deeply dispiriting to be present at this sham of justice and at this much wider demonization in public opinion of Julian, and this failure to present the true facts about the case from those whose job ought to be to present them. And in the court itself, it is impossible to sit in that court without realizing what you are watching is a charade, and that the magistrate has no real interest at all in the arguments, is not giving a fair hearing to the defence. Every single comment the magistrate makes is to query, question, or belittle the points which the defence have made. Her final comments, as we left today, were to point out that although the United States United Kingdom extradition treaty says you may not be extradited for a political offence, the Extradition Act in UK law does not say you may not be extradited for a political offence. Therefore, irrespective of the content of the treaty, a political offence may still be extraditable. Yesterday, we had the magistrate note that whether or not Julian Assange aided or abetted Chelsea Manning in any way was immaterial, because under the Official Secrets Act, which is the UK equivalent law under the dual criminality rule for extradition, merely to possess official secrets at all, unauthorized possession or unauthorized publication of official secrets, are themselves in strict liability illegal. Therefore, the question of whether or not Julian Assange colluded with Chelsea Manning was immaterial. He could be found liable and extradited anyway. And every single comment the magistrate has made has tended to favour the prosecution. There is not even the barest attempt at a coveting of impartiality. And there have been times when the trouble is you get drawn into the charade. You know, you see, we're going through this process, and you see the defense making some rather good points. Today, we had the defense completely demolish the argument that lives were put at risk by WikiLeaks in the publication of the Afghan war logs and in the publication of the diplomatic cables. That argument was completely demolished. And as well as that, the defense brought out the great good that was done and the terrible things that were revealed in the public interest in terms of extrajudicial killings, murder of children, murder of journalists, torture centers, black ops with death squads going around Afghanistan. And you sat there, and from time to time you think, wow, this is good. Wow, the defense are making good points. Wow, that's a strong argument. And then you realize it doesn't bloody matter, because there isn't a jury anyway. And we're not actually seeing a genuine process. Anyone who doesn't believe the fix is in is very naive. And the prosecution don't appear to be doing terrifically well. Several people keep coming up to me in the courtroom saying, it's going well, isn't it? And the prosecution, you know, they seem underprepared. Well, they are underprepared because they're not particularly trying, because they know that the verdict was decided before they set into the courtroom. They don't have to prepare. What we are witnessing is a show trial, as surely as anything Stalin did was a show trial. And we have to continue to fight this, and we have to continue to push this, and we have to continue to try to change public opinion, to change political opinion, and to convince the British establishment that this is something up with which the British people will not put. It's a long haul. I will be delighted, but absolutely shocked to my core if this magistrate decides against extradition. But I think we will get to appeal, and I think eventually we're going to win in the High Court or the Supreme Court. But that could be 2 or 3 years down the road. And for someone like me, who's a friend of Julian and knows him, to see him in his current physical and mental condition is extremely worrying. Today, later in the afternoon, the magistrate actually stopped proceedings for a while to ask whether he was in a fit state of health to continue, because he didn't look in a fit state of health to continue. And today we heard, in court, we heard that yesterday, after the trial, he was twice taken out of his cell and strip-searched. But he was 11 times handcuffed. 11 times he had handcuffs put on him and off him yesterday. And that all the papers his lawyers had given him in the court in order for him to be able to participate in his defense, all of the papers were taken off him by the prison. And those included confidential communications, privileged communications, between him and his lawyers on his defense. And the state has simply taken them. These are gross and vile abuses of process. And if there were any real sense of justice here, they would in themselves be enough to stop the proceedings. Just as yesterday, we heard how the CIA had arranged spying on him in the Ecuadorian embassy on legal conferences with his lawyers. The American state, which is beginning the extradition, has been spying on the defense. In any genuine process, that by itself would halt proceedings. But what we don't have is any genuine process. Now, I hope you will forgive me, because I'm tired. I'm a little shaken by all of this, shaken by the obvious brutality of it. But the obvious brutality of it is the point. And the purpose of the obvious brutality of it is to shake us. and to make us scared and to turn the whole world into compliant citizens, and it is not going to work, because up with this we will not put. What the Julian Assange case has always been about freedom. It's always been about our right as citizens to know of the crimes which governments commit in our name. It's always been about the right of the people to hold government to account. But it's widened beyond freedom of speech issues. It's turned into a question of the fundamental rule of law and whether there is any access to justice in our society. We are now engaged in a struggle for the heart of our society, in a struggle for whether there is any truth at all in the notion of a liberal democracy, in the notion of liberty, or whether power, untrammeled power, now has no limits, has no possibility of check. Whether the dream that the internet could open up new access, new ways for people to organize, to learn, to disseminate information, whether that dream can be crushed and information is again going to be limited to what's being put out by an increasingly restricted and increasingly lockstepped corporate media. We are engaged in a dreadful struggle, a struggle which is essentially the struggle against fascism. That is where we now stand, and you could not have it more perfectly illustrated than by seeing the goings-on at Woolwich Crown Court. And I am delighted that as we embark on this struggle, we are in such good company with each other. We may be tired, but it is not that we are in bad heart. We are in good heart. We are going to carry on, and we are going to win. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Craig Murray there. Excellent speech as ever. Right, for our second speaker, it'll be Mr. Alexander McCourris, who's publisher and editor of the Duran.
Well, it's always a privilege to follow Craig, and in some fact, some of the things I'm going to say, one could almost say that they draw both from some of the things he has said and, of course, some of the things he has done, some of the struggles he has fought in the past. But first, what I'd like to just say is, I mean, we hear all the time about whether or not this is a political trial, whether, in fact, Julian Assange, the extradition that is being requested of Julian Assange is because he's committed some kind of criminal offences or whether it's a political case. It is, of course, a political case. Let us have absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever. Julian Assange is a journalist. What he has done by providing us with information about the secrets of those in power is what journalists should do. That is perhaps not what journalists increasingly are doing, but it is what Julian Assange, as a journalist, is doing and has done. And the reason he is being tried, the United States is seeking his extradition, and the government is considering extraditing him to the United States, and we have all these hearings going on in Woolwich, is, of course, because of the person, the government, that is embarrassed and wants to keep all this secret. It is the United States government. It is clearly because He has embarrassed the United States government by exposing its secrets, exposing its war crimes, that he finds himself in the situation in which he is. And that makes this clearly a political, not a criminal case. That's the first thing to say. Now, I think there is something that follows from that, and that is, given that this is a political case, consider the way he has been treated. We've had a situation where Julian Assange is at the moment being heard. The case against him is taking place in Woolwich Crown Court. He's been kept in a glass cage. He's having difficulties communicating with his lawyers. He's been stripped, searched. His documents have been taken from him. This comes after years of confinement in the embassy, which caused him problems to his health. He's then been kept in a maximum security prison in Belmarsh. He's had restrictions on his movement, restrictions on his medical treatment. He's been kept in close confinement. He's been denied access many times to his lawyers. He's been placed under surveillance. His communications with his lawyers have been monitored in gross violation of the whole basic principle of legal professional privilege that is supposed to exist between an individual and his or her lawyers. That's a fundamental human right that has been understood and accepted since due process, the whole concept of due process, has come to be known. Well, how can that be explained other than by the fact that this is clearly a political case? And moreover, we have had no less a person than the UN, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, telling us that all of this treatment of Julian Assange has, in effect, amounted to his mistreatment, cruel and unusual punishments, borderline torture, perhaps even torture. Torture, conditions of confinement, which have had a very serious effect on his health. And let us always remember that there is another person involved in this case who is going through much of the same mistreatment, and I'm of course referring to Chelsea Manning. It always concerns me that so little has been said about Chelsea Manning, but she at the moment finds herself also in a state of indefinite detention because she is not prepared to give evidence against WikiLeaks. We don't know the whole story of this case, but clearly, it's clear to me that the case against Chelsea Manning, such as it is, the reason she's in confinement, is related to the case we have against Julian Assange. Chelsea Manning is being coerced to try to get her to give evidence. That is an outrageous thing. That is absolutely something that happens in the most brutal authoritarian societies. Now, we have heard so much over the course of Julian Assange's case about alleged abuse. I want to make it very clear, alleged abuse of women. Here is a woman, Chelsea Manning, being kept in indefinite detention, a woman who is being abused. Where are the protests? Where are the stern editorials in the newspapers? Where are the questions in Parliament, in chambers, in throughout the legal world, from the NGOs, about this person who finds herself in this situation? Now, I have to say, I am somebody who, in the first decade of my life, lived in a country, that's Greece, in the 60s, where due process collapsed, where there was a dictatorship, where torture became pervasive, where there was no freedom of speech. And I have to say, it was a deeply, deeply oppressive and frightening situation. And it was extraordinary to see, and even as a child I could sense it, how this affected the whole way in which society was run. And it seems to me that what we're seeing in Julian Assange's case, in Chelsea Manning's case, is that these practices, which, to be very clear, have been exported and used around the world by the United States government, by the British government, by our governments, they're being imported back to our home countries. So we see people, we see Julian Assange going through what Craig Murray has just described as a show trial. We see him being mistreated in full view, in full public view, in Belmarsh, at the Ecuadorian embassy. We see Chelsea Manning being kept, as I said, in indefinite detention and fined repeatedly to coerce her to give evidence. And it's not going to stop there. The reason this is happening is because when people like Craig Murray denounce the torture that was going on around the world against the enemies of our countries, not enough people made a stand. And we see it now happening in plain sight in our own countries, under our own jurisdictions, with the collusion, it seems, of our own courts and of our own legal systems. And this is an extraordinarily troubling thing, worse than troubling, for me, who saw it happen as a child in Greece, my home country. It is an astonishing thing that it could have come and spread here. And I ask this question: what sort of societies have we become where these sort of things can happen? And what sort of societies will we become if we allow these things to continue? Normalization of mistreatment and abuse, collapse of due process. It won't just be a few journalists, a few brave journalists, who then have to be afraid. It will spread inexorably to all of us. This is a cause that we have to win. Chelsea Manning is both an example to us, as well as an example of what may happen to us. She, by the stand she is taking, has shown extraordinary courage. We can do no less. I thank you for coming here.
Thank you, Alexander. Now, for our third speaker, our legend, the person who has spoken most at Imperialism on Trial events, but hasn't spoken for a while now, but the ever faithful Eva Bartlett has come from Canada. And Eva just doesn't report on countries. She goes and visits them as well and gets from the people themselves witness, eyewitness. Thank you. Eva Bartlett, please.
Good evening. I'm going to depart a little bit from the central theme of Julian Assange, mainly because so many excellent speakers on the panel are addressing his case so eloquently. But I want to address the broader issue of freedom of press and cracking down on journalists. And I'm going to give some examples, starting with Ukraine. And I'll give one case example, which thankfully has a happy ending, but it's one that I'm very familiar with, which is why I'm going to address it, because this particular case is one that happens again and again and again in Ukraine, to the silence of Western corporate media, to the silence of the bodies that are supposed to be concerned about journalist rights and freedoms. So in May 2018, journalist and editor Kirill Vyshinsky was taken into detention, into pre-trial detention by Ukrainian authorities under the pretenses of having committed high state treason against Ukraine. And now the funny thing, that there are many correlations with his case and the case against Julian Assange in that it's so absurd, and we can clearly see how absurd it is and how there's no legal basis for holding them. In the case of Vyshinsky, the evidence that was presented against him was the fact that he, as a publisher for RIA Novosti, had published 15 articles of differing opinions on what was happening in Ukraine regarding the political situation there, and it had both articles that had opinions that were critical of the government and articles that had opinions that were not critical. None of them were written by he himself, and they all had a byline stating this. And yet, 4 years after the fact, the Ukrainian authorities decided that he was suddenly very, very dangerous to the state and he must be imprisoned. So they kept him in pretrial detention, continually delaying and prolonging his detention, never actually giving him a trial. And then his case got even more absurd. I have to just take a look at my notes here. He had, there were 31 volumes of case files. Each volume had between 250 to 400 pages front and back, and he was extremely limited in the time that he could actually see these files in order to know what the supposed evidence and all this stuff that they had collected on him contained. And so I interviewed his lawyer in Kiev, and his lawyer, Andrei Domansky, actually told me that the authorities were starting to come after him in hopes that they could then prevent him from defending Kirill. But anyway, fast forward to the end. He was released in August 2019 in an exchange, although he was never actually tried. He was never actually convicted of anything. But his case, and when I was writing about this, I got in touch with another journalist, Pavel Volkov, and he told me he was subject to the same types of accusations without evidence, and he was held in the same pretrial detention center as Kirill Vyshinsky on charges of, quote, infringing on territorial integrity with a group of people and miscellaneous accessory to terrorism. And then he said that in March 2019 he was acquitted, but his case wasn't fully finished. And he said basically the leaders of the 2014 Euromaidan movement subsequently occupied positions in the government, in the leadership, and they believe that anyone who wants peace with the Russian Federation, who believes that the Russian language should be the second state language, is the enemy of Ukraine. And according to him, this formed the basis of new criminal law designed to persecute politicians, public figures, journalists, and even ordinary citizens who disagree with the above. So I have a list of many journalists that are being persecuted by the Ukrainian authorities, many similar cases to Kirill Vyshinsky. And I guess the point I want to make is this is being done in a state that is allied with Western nations, where we would say our governments, I should say, would say this is a democratic state, and yet they're practicing very undemocratic, draconian practices against civilians and journalists. So that's one thing I just wanted to bring up, because it is ongoing, and again, none of these journalist bodies that I'm aware of are really looking into it. I know that when I looked into the case of Kirill Vyshinsky, I couldn't even find his name in the entries of committee, not Committee to Protect Journalists, but the other bodies that supposedly are concerned with journalist rights. I will move on briefly to another country. I'm not very well versed in this. I'm just aware that in Estonia, the Estonian authorities were ready to charge around, I believe it was 35 employees of Sputnik with criminal prosecution leading up to prison terms of 5 years if they didn't stop working for Rusia Savonia. And then the pretext upon that was that the Rusia Savonia general director, sanctions had been imposed on him, but What Savonia says is that the sanctions imposed on the general director have nothing to do whatsoever with Sputnik. And they clearly say that Sputnik are not included in any EU sanctions list. So these journals are being targeted by the Estonian authorities on baseless premises. They did actually have to stop their work with Sputnik. But this is another example, and I think this is an important one to bring up because this ties in with the whole Russophobic censorship of any sort of Russian media. Like, for example, last summer there was a media freedom conference in the UK, and Sputnik and Russia Today were explicitly not given accreditation. And in fact, a Canadian journalist that went there said that the journalists that he saw that were there from Canada were handpicked, who could actually ask questions to Jeremy Hunt or Chrystia Freeland, the two co-sponsors of this Freedom Conference, Media Freedom Conference. And in my opinion, when I looked at the characters that were there, like Christian Amanpour or some of the worst war propagandists on Syria, for example, it was more like a regime change conference, not a media freedom conference. But this is the type of thing we're facing. And again, back to the issue of Russian media and the in this case, the persecution of Sputnik in Estonia, it does tie in with all this incessant Russophobic content. And in my personal opinion, you may be aware I've done reporting from Syria. What I've seen in Russian reporting on Syria has been very accurate, in contrast to the reports of the BBC, CNN, Guardian, Channel 4, CBC, etc. And I'm often, I've been accused of being on the payroll of the Russian government or something like that, because what I have written from Syria aligns quite often with what Russian media writes. But the point has been that Russia actually has correspondents on the ground, just as there are independent correspondents on the ground seeing what's actually happening in Syria and not reporting from Istanbul or Washington or Beirut. So that's a bit of a tangent, but I wanted to mention that. And finally, I just want to mention that on the issue of persecuted journalists, I'd also just like to acknowledge that there are many journalists who have been murdered, for example, again in Syria or in Palestine, while covering events. And their murders are never worthy of mention in Western corporate media, because the viralities that they were covering, whether in occupied Palestine or in Syria, are not fit for print in Western media. So in 2014, I wrote an article, and I detailed some of these journalists who had been murdered by Western-backed terrorists in Syria. And sadly, at the time when I wrote it, there were 30 Syrian, Lebanese, Iraqi allied journalists that had been murdered. I would say, sadly, that number is much more. But I remember when I was researching for that piece, take for the example the name Yara Abbas. She was a journalist with Al-Ikhbariya, and her car was ambushed by a terrorist sniper, and she was killed. Now, when I found an entry on her murder in the Committee to Protect Journalists, it said, quote, Abbas, a correspondent for the pro-government TV channel, was killed when her car came under rebel sniper fire, according to Syrian news sources. And the point I want to make about that is the whole lexicon there. She's not a journalist. She's a pro-government journalist, therefore not really worthy of our attention or our concern. And of course, then to imply that it was a heroic rebel that killed her and not a terrorist is also another form of misuse of lexicon designed to render her murder unimportant in the eyes of Westerners. So unfortunately, to add to that list, we have Khaled al-Khatib, who was killed in 2017 by ISIS shelling. To my knowledge, he didn't get a whole lot of coverage in Western press. And there's Serena Shim, who was bravely and courageously covering the entrance of terrorists from Turkey into Syria, and also the role of Turkey in training terrorists that then went on into Syria. One or two days before, she had a surprising car accident, a very mysterious and I think many of us are skeptical that it was actually a car accident. She was on Press TV saying that she feared for her life, that she was being threatened by Turkish intelligence, and then some days later she died. And her mother has been asking and pushing for some sort of investigation into her death. And the last time I checked, there had been none. And Serena Shim was an American citizen. But again, this is just to show sometimes people's lives matter when it serves a propaganda purpose, when you can demonize Russia or demonize Syria, whichever country America and its allies are targeting. And then most of the other times, the lives of these journalists that are killed or imprisoned don't matter. I'm going to go way off topic just to address the issue, the situation in Syria very briefly. It's not that way off topic because it's still in the realm of media and media portrayal of events in Syria. Right now, Syria and Russia are continuing to work to liberate Idlib, liberate the civilians of Idlib. And Western corporate media, which cares so much about civilians in Syria that they will cry at the drop of a hat, are ignoring the presence of al-Qaeda in Idlib. And they're demonizing Syria and they're demonizing Russia. We have various Western officials that have surprisingly been very honest about the fact that Idlib is infested with al-Qaeda. I'm sure you're aware of Brett McGurk, the former U.S. envoy, who said it was the largest al-Qaeda safe haven since 9/11. And more recently, a muck-up on Sky News when Colonel Miles Kagans, U.S. coalition spokesperson, said Idlib province seems to be a magnet for terrorist groups. And said, he went on to say, they're a nuisance, there's many of them there, they're a menace and a threat to the thousands of civilians trying to make it through the winter. So he kind of screwed up Sky News' attempt to make it all about civilians. And nobody's saying, of course, that there aren't civilians in Idlib, but the whole point is, when Idlib is liberated, then the civilians will be free. And we've seen this with Eastern Ghouta and Aleppo and many, many places prior. You may also be aware that a week or so ago, Aleppo's countryside was liberated of, terrorists in the countryside were eradicated. And this did not get, to my knowledge, any play in the corporate media. But if you're watching Syrian social media channels, Syrian media, Russian media, independent media, you would have seen Syrians celebrating the fact that for the first time since the war in Syria began, they were truly free of terrorism in Aleppo City. So I'd like to just close by recommending a really excellent article by Canadian author Stephen Gowans. I don't have the name at hand, but you can Google Stephen Gowans. He makes the point, he points out the hypocrisy of how the West demonizes Syria and Russia for fighting terrorism. And I think every one of us, if we asked what would we do in our countries, if our city, our province, whatever was overrun by terrorists, what would we expect of our government? And the answer clearly is that they would stop the terrorists so that we would not be slaughtered and maimed, so we would not worry about our children and loved ones. So I'm just going to quote from Gowan's article. He says, the Syrian army, backed by the Russian and Iranian allies, launched an offensive to liberate Idlib. It's done this because al-Qaeda's attacks have never stopped, and because the government of Syria has an obligation to protect its citizens and control its own territory. We ought to applaud the actions of the Syrian military along with those of the Russian and Iranian allies, not deplore them. These actions are blows against reaction, oppression, and foreign aggression, and in defense of democracy on an international level, as well as the furtherance of the welfare of the Syrian people. Thank you.
Thank you very much there, Eva. Wonderful speech as ever. Just before I introduce our next speaker, there's a few things that I wanted to say. Well, I'd like to thank you all for attending. I would like to thank all the speakers for coming here tonight and giving their wonderful expertise on the subject of imperialism and on Julian Assange. And could also like to thank RT UK, who make these events possible by live streaming. Right. I just wanted to mention, yes, Neil. I just wanted to mention something about peacemakers in the world, and maybe even politicians that talk peace. We're talking here Tulsi Gabbard. We're talking Saunders, and As soon as these people come up and put their head above the parapet and talk about peace in this world, they are labelled Russian stooges. What a fucking joke. Do you know? You know,
why are you standing? Why are you saying that with me standing?
Imagine equating Russia with peace. Strange concept, that, isn't it? Well, of course it's true. Russia represents peace in this world. And they, the bastards, the imperialist bastards that are framing Julian Assange, aren't fit to kiss the arses of the Russians. Thank you. That's my bit.
That's a really nice introduction. Maybe can we do a cross? Can we do a crosstalk right now? You're all fired up.
So yes, could I just introduce? This is Peter Lavelle. I'm sure you all know Peter Lavelle. Peter Lavelle is bar none, the best presenter of a politics show. Thank you, Peter.
You know why? Because we have freedom of speech where I work. We really do. You know. The number of people that have come up to me and say, is that earpiece connected to the Kremlin? No. You know, people always ask me, I always say, you know, the good thing is about my job is that they leave me alone. And the bad thing is that they leave me alone. So I'm always kind of out of the loop, you know. I have no idea what the newsroom is doing. I don't actually watch much television, okay. That tends to blur your vision, unfortunately, most television. I was going to start out by saying it's really good we're doing this in a church, okay? Because this is where you have faith and where you have hope. And it brings people of good faith together. Because the people out there don't have it. And they show it every single day. They insult our intelligence. They insult our sense of morality. Now, I'm not a legal expert, and I'm glad we have people here that are. But this is just an abomination of justice. And we're all Julian Assange that way, and I don't mean to be trite, all right? Julian Assange is a world historic individual right now. You know, in the 10 years while he was there running WikiLeaks, you know what's the most important thing he did for me and my friends, my small circle of friends, and my international community through to my television program? You know what Julian Assange did in WikiLeaks? He told us, he informed us that we're not crazy. We all had these ideas out there, you know, trying to connect the dots. And then, you know, and there are people out there trolling on the internet, trying with their disinformation, their fake news, okay? And then you read the cables, then you read the emails, and you know what? It was like, whew, it's true. It's all true. And they gave us the details to connect all of those dots. That's why he's on trial right now, because he exposed the truth. He exposed the crimes of people that will get away with it with impunity. And this is that's why it makes him a world historic individual. And we live in a media age of not just propaganda, not just fake news, but omission. They wipe you away. They disappear you. And this is what they will continue to do, and they do it in broad daylight. Another thing that makes Julian Assange a world historic individual is that he's exposed how much the media is a fraud. Complete fraud. Completely in bed with power. That's all they care about is power. You know how much talent it takes to read a piece of glass on a teleprompter? Not much. Okay? They'll pay for your teeth, they pay for your clothes, they'll pay for your nice hair, and all you have to smile and you mimic their lies, and they do it gladly. Why? Because in the age of Twitter, of fame, in egoism, in nihilism, and Julian Assange and WikiLeaks is antithetical to all of that. Because he and WikiLeaks are authentic, unlike the frauds that govern us and the frauds that broadcast to us 24/7. All they do is insult us. This farcical trial has a parallel in the United States, and it's called Roger Stone. Okay, Roger Stone, he's a prankster, all right? He's boastful. He makes wild claims. That's his job. He's a political operative. But they need Julian Assange. They need to discredit him and Roger Stone to tie the bow on this ridiculous Russiagate hoax. They're bringing it back by those authoritative, you know, secret sources, okay? They do it again, anonymous sources. Who is that? Have you ever met Mr. Anonymous? I haven't. They're all in the deep state, and the deep state is connected all around the world. They cover for each other. All right? A good deal of this Russiagate hoax originated in this country and in Ukraine. And they're serving it up again because they have nothing else to say to us. Another important thing is empire is the glue that keeps these elites together. They you know, the Republican and the Democrat, you know, Labor, Tory. No. That's their facade. That's their selling points, okay? It's empire that keeps them together, and they will go to great lengths to protect their empire because it is at our expense, and it's at the expense of our civilization, of our moral code. And lastly, we have seen regime change all, particularly since the end of the Cold War, but it's been going on. I mean, it's all part and parcel of what the West does to the world. But regime change has come home. They perfected it in countries like Libya, where they'll never apologize for what they did. All right? And now they've brought it home. They brought it to your country. They brought it to the country where I'm from. They're doing it on us now. Okay? They're taking our votes away from us. And they're taking away our democracy. And what they do 24/7, we do it for democracy. No, they do it for their own goddamn selfish reasons. And we are all poorer for it. And Julian Assange, I will say it last time, is a world historic figure because he has revealed to us truth and how we should live in dignity. And it shows how our justice system is in tatters, how politicized it is. And they say they're morally superior to us. Is that if we disagree, we're somehow seditious, we're immoral, we're unpatriotic. I've never seen such unpatriotic elites in my life. Okay? Populism is something that is rising all through the Western world. And it's not a dirty word. It's not a dirty word. Some people do abuse it, I agree. But it's our way of saying we want our control back. We want control of our destiny. And you people, you mandarins in power, don't have the moral authority to say one word to us. Because there's a spark of divinity in all of us. And don't let these people take it away from us. Don't let them take it away from Julian Assange.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for coming all the way from Moscow to be with us tonight. And that was an excellent speech, I'm sure you'll all agree. Now, here we had a conservative. And would you call George Galloway a conservative?
No!
But we, at Imperials in Montreal, are a broad church. And as imperialists worldwide know, we are also a broad church. We're tolerant of others that have difference of opinions. Some people here have different views on social issues. Some are more conservative, some are more liberal. The same with economics. We generally all be very much on the left, but sometimes there are people like Peter that are more conservative, and that's fair enough. But what we're all driven by is a passion for peace and anti-imperialism and anti-neoliberalism. That's free speech too. Thank you. Thank you. So, could I welcome our fifth speaker here, Mr. George Galloway.
Thank you. Gregor, I hope you didn't mean that I'm a liberal. Honourable Craig Murray, my RT colleague Peter Lavelle, honourable speakers, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, this is a magnificent event attended by people, as Greg said, of different political stripes, but united in solidarity with prisoner number A9379AY, the world historic figure, Julian Assange. I just want to, in parenthesis, make this point. I said the Honourable Craig Murray. All of the speakers are honourable. But he is right, honourable. You see, people like me had no choice but to take this path. We were born into it. We had no alternatives. The struggle against imperialism was the only choice that we had. But Craig Murray had a glittering career in the British Foreign Office, Her Majesty's ambassador to Uzbekistan. And he threw it all away because he stood up for justice against torture, against disappearances, against political repression. He threw it all away. He could have kept his head down, been the ambassador for here and for there, and have a knighthood. Well, they may not give you a knighthood, but you'll always be Sir Craig Murray to me. Yes. 10 years ago, exactly on this day, I was kidnapped by the thugs of the dictator Hosni Mubarak, who died today. I was kidnapped in the dead of night. I was taken by men without uniform who couldn't speak English, even if they had wanted to tell me who they were and where they were taking me. They drove me for many hours, I knew not where, and deposited me at the airport in Cairo, served me with the certificate, which I proudly hold, a blue paper, declaring me persona non grata and no longer welcome in Egypt. And I have to tell you that the legal proceedings as described here this evening and in the various blogs, because that's the only place you're going to read anything substantive about what's going on in blogs like Craig Murray's and many others, these legal proceedings would have been more fitting in Hosni Mubarak's dictatorship in Egypt than in a country like Britain, which is supposed to be a Western democracy. Who cannot tremble with indignation at what happened to Julian Assange just yesterday? Never mind over the last decade. Just yesterday, this man, who should be in Oslo getting the Nobel Peace Prize, was being stripped and searched by goons, handcuffed, held in 5 different cells in one day, handcuffed 11 times, handcuffed for what? He was in a bulletproof box all day in the court. What were they searching him up his backside for? Why did they take his legal papers away? Talk about an abuse of process. This is an obscenity in a country that pretends to believe in the rule of law and justice. Who cannot tremble with indignation when we learn that every movement, literally, Craig, every time we went to the toilet in the Ecuadorian embassy, the CIA were watching it on video. I'm not exaggerating. There was a camera in the toilet where Pamela Anderson peed, where Craig Murray and me and others who have the honor to be friends of Julian Assange, but much more importantly than our movements, they spied on every legal meeting that Julian had with his representatives in absolute brazen defiance of the rules of justice and the lawyer-client privilege. As Craig pointed out, in any other, if you were in court because your dog had fouled the pavement and this kind of abuse of process was unveiled by the defense, the case would be thrown out immediately. No trial can take place when it's been corrupted from the beginning in this way. Who cannot tremble with indignation at the idea that the I'm coming to that point. Who cannot tremble with indignation at the idea that the man that blew the whistle on the war crimes is in Belmarsh and the war criminals are on the BBC and ITV and raking in millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds? The criminals have made it a crime to report on the crimes that they committed. Ponder that. That's now the country that we are living in. Who cannot tremble with indignation? Well, 95% at least of Britain's journalists didn't even show up today to hear the defense's argument. 95% of Britain's broadcasters are not trembling with indignation. If you cannot tremble with indignation at any injustice anywhere, you are not a human being. You have no pulse and you have no soul. And that's the reality of the so-called Fourth Estate in this country. I spit upon them. This church should be bulging with journalists, because if they had any intention of actually doing their job, what is happening to Julian Assange is a mortal danger to them. It's a knife at their heart. It's a sword of Damocles hanging over their heads. If they ever intended to actually be journalists. But of course, the truth is, most of them have sold whatever soul they had just for a ribbon to put on their coat, just for a shilling or two. They have abandoned any claim of moral authority. And these are the people that lecture us, especially at election times. Speaking of which, on the principle that it's better late than never, I'm glad that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell have finally found a voice to speak up in favour of Julian Assange. And if they'd done so earlier, we might have been further down the road to getting Julian out of Belmarsh. Now, I only have time to make two more quick points. And again, they relate to what the Honourable Craig Murray said. You see, I was there when this extradition treaty was reached. It was concluded behind the backs of Parliament, during the summer recess, when no member of parliament could question the treaty which David Blunkett, Tony Blair's Home Secretary, corruptly and secretly concluded with the United States, a one-sided extradition treaty, the likes of which no free country would ever sign with any other country, where they'd never have to send anybody to us, whatever they've done, even if it's killing a young boy on a motorway because you're driving up the wrong side of the road. You don't have to send anybody to us. But we will send anybody to you without even just cause having to be produced. But when Parliament returned in the autumn, I bearded David Blunkett in the members' lobby and told him all the things that I thought were wrong and dangerous with this extradition treaty. And he said to me, "You're worrying unnecessarily because all of the points you're making are taken care of by Article 4.1 of the treaty, which precludes the extradition of people in Britain for political offences to the United States." And now the judge is telling us that although that's on the face of the treaty, it does not apply. What madness is this? And the second point. Sorry? Windrush. That's another meeting. I'll come back to that. The last point then that I have time to make is this. If we allow, if the British public allows, if the British media allows, if the British political class allows, and remember this has to be rubber stamped, signed off by the current Home Secretary, Priti Patel. So public opinion has a role here. He cannot be sent from this country without a politician, an elected politician, a member of an elected government signing the final extradition order. If we allow Julian Assange to be sent for the rest of his life, the rest of his life, into the dungeons of the US injustice system, journalism, freedom, freedom of speech, democracy itself will have been murdered in plain sight on our watch. And that's why we are going to fight and fight and fight again to free Julian Assange. Free Julian Assange.
Wow. I've heard many of electrifying speeches by George, but that one was something else. Bravo, George Galloway. Right. Now, we're going to have our first time testing anything like this, but we're going to now have the second stage, and it'll be like a crosstalk, like a live version of crosstalk. So if I could ask those that are still going to be on the panel to remain seated or to sit, that'll be Peter Lavelle will be here, Eva Bartlett, Mike Barson, Neil Clark, Judy Brower, and Joe Loria. So if anyone that's not there, can they just sit behind? Right, ladies and gentlemen, this is the second part of tonight's, this is our crosstalk panel. As I've already mentioned, we've got Joe Loria, Judy Brower, Eva Bartlett, Neil Clark, and from the British band, the hugely successful British band, Madness, Mike Barson, ladies and gentlemen. And our wonderful host, Peter Lavelle. So take it away there, Peter.
All right, this is a special edition of Crosstalk. I've never done anything like this before, so I'm actually going to do it for everybody because I associate it with the program, my whole introduction, so I'm going to do it for all of you. Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. I am so happy we have Mike on the panel because he knows something about madness, okay? The madness where you entertained us and enlightened us, made us think. Unfortunately, the kind of madness that we're being presented today in reality is something of a very different quantity. Looking outside, because you know the public very well, what is the tension between what the powers that be want us to believe, which almost none of us do? It's not top of mind for people at all. It's top of mind for people that actually care and inform, because the media won't inform you. What they do is they have a policy of omission, as I said. So, Mike, your thoughts.
Sorry, Peter, say that again. What was the question?
I mean, we live in a mad time right now.
Yes.
And we have political elites that are divorcing themselves from us. They're leaving us. And we have to decide what to do about that.
Yeah. I think, from my experience, that's very much the case. Yeah, I think the people are losing their... I mean, I don't know how much they've ever had the voice with the political system, but I think definitely the political system is drifting off, you know. And it's not representing... I mean, when I look at the debates that go on in Parliament, I sometimes don't know what the hell they're talking about, you know. It's like ordinary people. It's completely wrapped up in their whole thing. This whole thing with the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn and all this stuff that they were arguing about, it's just like something completely alien, I think, to normal people and what normal people want. And with this, what's happening with Julian, I think it's of great concern that our country is under threat and that our you know, legal system is under threat from what we've heard from everybody who's been speaking. That's a great concern. And I don't know what's the way out of it, you know, but I think it's a very unhealthy situation, yeah. Politicians are supposed to represent people. They're supposed to represent our interests.
That's the problem, because they've forgotten that they represent us. No, we're supposed to reflect their views, apparently, okay? That is the crisis of confidence. Neil, jump in.
Yeah, I quite agree. I don't think there's been a time, certainly when... in my lifetime, when the political elite have been so way out of touch, as Mike said, with public opinion. And you put on Parliament, and the only time we show genuine internationalism, a genuine concern, is when there's something that can be pinned on the official enemy. When there's something that can be blamed on Russia or the Syrian government, all the MPs turn up and they all say exactly the same thing, now that George Galloway's not there or Tony Benn's passed on, all say exactly the same thing. Something's got to be done. The new Hitler's doing this, doing that. And that's the only time you get international affairs covered there, really. And the unanimity of the House of Commons is another factor, I think. They're all singing from the same hymn sheet. I think it was Peter that you said this earlier, that Labour, Conservative, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. And what's happened here in the last 5 years is very fascinating, because he was a 500-to-1 shot. Jeremy Corbyn became the Labour Party leader in 2015. Against all the odds, he was only nominated, got the last nomination literally seconds before the deadline. He was there to sort of make up the numbers. Of course, the leadership rules had changed, the members had a vote, and to the absolute horror of the pro-war establishment, this guy who I have sat next to on panels like this. In fact, I was on one only about 7 years ago, a Stop the War panel next to Jeremy Corbyn. And if you'd have said to me, this guy will be the Labour leader in just a few years' time, I would have thought that would be quite remarkable. And it was. And that panicked the establishment. And I think what we've seen here in the last 5 years is an interesting case study of how the establishment works to destroy somebody who potentially posed a threat. The sad thing about it all was that we had a real chance here with the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn in 2015. If Jeremy Corbyn had carried on being the Jeremy Corbyn that he was beforehand, if he had done all of that,
I agree.
If he had stayed true and loyal to his comrades instead of, I'm afraid, allowing them to be thrown under the bus, and if he had actually taken on his enemies really from day one in the party, we may well be in a very different position here today. But tragically, having been only 2,700 votes or so away from being Prime Minister in 2017, he threw it all away, I'm afraid to say. But what he was subject to and the attacks that he was subject to, I think, will be studied for years to come. The smear campaigns, the fake news, and tragically, he didn't push back against that.
Yeah, but don't you think Bernie Sanders is falling into the same situation?
Totally. And I think, I'm afraid, the likelihood is that that will end the same way.
I'm sorry, we live in an age, I'm sorry, I'm going to be rude once in a while. Sometimes it's necessary, all right? Because you have this duopoly of the establishment. And you have also in the Labour Party, unfortunately, you guys had, I'm a conservative here, but, you know, you had the never Corbyns, okay? And the same thing that you have in the Democratic Party in the United States, never Bernies in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I mean, if Jeremy Corbyn had really carried on being Jeremy Corbyn, and if he'd had the vigour and the drive that we just saw there from George Galloway, and the fearlessness of George Galloway, we'd probably have him in Downing Street now. And Julian Assange would be free. So a great opportunity was, I'm afraid, wasted.
Okay, Evan, one of the things I think it's very interesting, and I can't obviously speak from first-hand experience because I don't live in the UK, but more and more so, voters are taking, and they're doing it on their own, becoming more and more interested in foreign policy. And this terrifies the elites. It absolutely terrifies them because there is a bipartisan view of foreign policy. And it is, most people here like to use the term imperialism. I prefer empire. And that really irks the elites that people like us are talking more and more about it. And me being in media, stepping aside and saying that, you know, I'm not going to just follow the talking points from power. And that's all you see in media.
Well, as you know, I'm not from the UK either. I actually wanted to kind of add on to what you were saying about the policy of omission, and which applies both to media and politicians, obviously. And again, if you look at issues like Venezuela or Syria, the media has omitted the vast majority of people that would basically counter their narratives.
Right.
So, like, and I think Jyoti can add on to this because she was just in Venezuela. But when I was there a year ago, you know, people were I won't say the complete majority, but there was a huge segment of the population that support their government. And our media was saying that Maduro is illegitimate, that Juan Guaido is the new interim president, and most people I talked to didn't even know who he was, you know. And then if you look at Syria, the media has maintained a policy of omitting Syrian voices because if they had actually deigned to interview them, they would learn that Syrians support their president, that they actually support their army and they comprise the army, and that they don't want this so-called revolution that's been foisted on them. They want to return to peace and stability. So, I mean, as far as the media, these omissions have a huge effect because I think most people in the West don't have time to dig and research
right
into what's going on in Syria, and then they're fed. If I may, the other day I saw that CNN was regurgitating their war propaganda and lies from 2018. They just updated it to February 2020. And they were saying, quote unquote, the regime is bombing Eastern Ghouta. You're all aware that Eastern Ghouta was liberated 2 years ago. Why the hell would the government be bombing an area that was liberated and where its own people and army are?
Well, I mean, they're regurgitating a lot of things. I mean, Russiagate suddenly was taken off of life support. I mean, you never know when these things can happen, okay? Jyoti, it's not in the elites have no interest in having a real debate about foreign policy because if we were told the truth, okay, if dissident voices were allowed. I mean, and it's happening more and more on the internet if you can survive YouTube's demonetization and all of these other things here. But I think it is really kind of fascinating is that you find out that empire or imperialism here is actually not good for the average person, and that's why it is something that is not debated in public whatsoever. People always fall. I mean, even, you know, again, as a conservative, watching Bernie Sanders regurgitate Russiagate talking points, I mean, I'm just mystified by it, just simply mystified by it, okay? He doesn't have to go down that path, but as I said in my presentation, it's empire that keeps them all together. They're a cadre. Okay, and they're terrified of having any kind of public debate about it.
I think that's absolutely right, Peter. I mean, you talk about the empire and we talk about imperialism, but what you've identified is the fact that inside of imperialist politics, as I would call it, bourgeois politics, the officially recognized political spectrum goes from the left to the right of bourgeois imperialist politics. And outside of that, is officially doesn't exist. So what you were talking about, both of you, about this omission, I come from the communist left. I don't even call myself left anymore because left has become a term for left imperialist.
But they left you.
A liberal. I'm not a liberal. I'm in favour of the working class and opposed to imperialism. And that doesn't exist in the spectrum that's officially recognised. I feature fully in the world of omission. You know, people like me don't exist. We do not exist in the media. Our voice, our viewpoint, for example, Brexit happened recently. You would not know from British mainstream media coverage that there were progressive, working class reasons for supporting Brexit. The only reason you heard...
I didn't know.
The only reasons that are given in the media are right-wing, you know, nationalist, racist reasons. But the reasons that the working class had for voting for Brexit were never expressed. And after the ruling class lost that vote, were shocked to find that they could lose a vote when they told us how to vote and we didn't go along with it. We have been bombarded ever since with a narrative of how backward and racist and awful we are and how we shouldn't be allowed to vote again.
Yes. Yeah, the people that distrust the democratic process the most are the elites, okay? Because so much has been taken away from us. And the only thing we're left with the ballot box, and now they want to manipulate that also. And that's what terrifies them. Joe, I'm going to put you on the hot spot here. Why did journalists go along with it? Explain.
Well, there's one journalist that's filled in the omissions.
Yes.
I saw him today in that cage in Woolwich Crown Court. That's the mistake that he's made from the point of view of the rulers, that he is actually filling in extraordinary information about what especially the United States and its lackey allies are doing around the world and the crimes they commit, and that cannot be tolerated.
Absolutely not tolerated.
For example, you talk about a bipartisan consensus in the U.S. on foreign policy. I mean, I thought the impeachment of Donald Trump was a joke. He made a call to the Ukrainian president. That's something he shouldn't have done. It was a blunder that the Department of Justice should have dealt with. Biden, who definitely should be investigated.
Quid pro quos never happen.
Right, that's the routine way of foreign policy. I mean, I can go on and list so many examples of that. John Bolton going around and threatening the children of the OPCW director and also going around the world, if you don't conclude a bilateral treaty with the U.S. on the ICC, we're going to cut off aid. So that's absolutely. But I do think, and you may not agree, that Donald Trump, and he's not the worst president in history, but he has committed a war crime, at least his administration has. For example, saying, we're going to steal Syria's oil. That's against the 1905 Hague Convention. That's called pillage. The drone assassinations of Soleimani and innocent civilians. He's also recognizing the colonies in the West Bank of Israel as being legal is a violation of the Geneva Convention. And the fourth one would be he pardoned a war criminal. Actually, they'd actually put it. Low-level guy, of course. And he pardoned him. That could be an accessory to war crime after the fact. Why wasn't he impeached for this? Because it's this bipartisan consensus.
Right.
We cannot discuss this because future presidents want to be able to do that. We don't want to shine light on past presidents. And so they give him a pass on the worst things that he's doing.
But Joe, why does the media give the pass? Because I'll portray my age just a little bit here. But I remember watching in black and white and television journalists that towed the line for Vietnam for years. And then a few of them, the television journalists primarily, they went to Vietnam. And they were in what we would call embedded, and they were shown around, and they saw it was a complete lie and a complete fraud. It was no coincidence that you had the Pentagon Papers and you had some members of the media start saying, whoa, it was before the Pentagon Papers. And they came out and said, we're not winning, we cannot win. And they stayed on the air. Phil Donahue, very popular figure in the United States, he doubted the Iraq War. Have you ever heard from him since? No. John Mearsheimer, one of the most preeminent international relations theorists in the world, at the University of Chicago, he's written the textbook. It's definitive. He was on TV in 2003. He said this is a farce in Iraq. The last time he was on television was my program a couple years ago. He's been banned, vanished, gone. So, Joe, why?
I'll give you another example. Well, as you said in your talk, careerism, but I also think the popular demonstration against the war pushed the media against the war as well. But is a better example, or another example, that's Daniel Ellsberg. His case was thrown out in a mistrial. Why? Because they bugged his phone, and a psychiatrist's office was broken into, and the judge in his case, in his trial, was bribed with the possibility of becoming FBI director if he did the right thing. Was thrown out. Now we have UC Global, as I think George alluded to, spying on the privileged conversations between Assange and his lawyers. In other words, the prosecuting government eavesdropped on the defense preparations of the defendant. This would be thrown out immediately, but this will probably not happen. We don't know. We're hoping. I asked Varoufakis, what's his name? Yanis Varoufakis outside the rally. Yeah, I can't say it one time. I asked him that, and he said things have gotten worse. Well, clearly things have gotten much, much worse. And today, when in that courtroom, I saw how the lawyer for Assange, Mark Summers, totally demolished the government's argument. They went in there with such a flimsy argument because of hubris. They just think they're going to win. I just want to quickly say that when you read the indictment, it says that Assange tried to help Chelsea Manning get a password, to crack a password, to get into what the indictment says, or she has legal access to, she had top secret to it. Well, it's worse than that. We learned today that the password he was trying to help her crack was to get music videos and games to download, because it's illegal in the army for the soldiers to have these things. That's what that was about. It's extraordinary. And, of course, the idea that he risked lives, it's not against the law to reveal the name of an informant. It is an agent, but not an informant. And they demolished that as well. Julian Assange had a harm mitigation program. Der Spiegel said they never experienced anything as stringent as that. David Lee of The Guardian called Der Spiegel complaining he's taking too long because he's redacting too many names, Assange. I mean, totally demolished that. And the third part of that was this most wanted list of documents. That's so what if a journalist is asking, I want this story.
Oh,
I want
God my source to give me want to know that.
So it is a complete fraud and was demolished today, but we cannot rest that the judge will do the right thing.
The interesting thing is, again, the way the media always frames this, you know, from the Podesta emails and to the cables that were released. I mean, it was already pointed out here, the United States and its pliant allies were just completely red-faced. You can't shame power. There will be retribution for that. But the point is that, okay, a journalist and a publisher, well, they want, that's their job, to look at the powerful. That's what the... if I can be American-centric for a few seconds, it is the only profession mentioned in the American Constitution, the work and rights and privileges of journalists. The only profession that's mentioned in that document. So, but the problem is, they're always talking about how these government documents came into the public eye. They never talk about what's in the documents. They never do. It's always glossed over. That's why, and that is the sin of Julian Assange, is that he revealed the truth when we know, when he's on trial in this country, and we have members of the American political elite that lied to Congress, now have very well-paid gigs on cable TV. And they're not facing justice, okay? Because there is a two-tier justice system. There's one for us, and there's one for them. And people know it now. It's so obvious. Jump in.
I just wanted to come back on that, because I think a lot of things in recent years, and Julian Assange's case is one of them, have been teaching people lessons about the nature of the state that the state would much rather we didn't know. And they used to be much better at hiding these things from us. They've become careless, partly because actually they're quite divided, our rulers. They are divided. That's how Trump got elected. That's how Brexit happened. There's divisions amongst the ruling class. There's a crisis. They're fighting about how to survive it. We're learning lessons about the nature of the media, about the nature of the justice system, about the nature of the police and the army, the crimes that our rulers are prepared to commit abroad, the corporatocracy, they call that. You know, behind closed doors, who is talking to who and who's issuing the orders to whom? You know, we apparently elect our representatives, but who do they really represent? We just had in this country, after the Brexit vote, we watched our elected representatives, who are supposedly answerable to us, spend 3.5 years arguing with one another about how not to do the thing they were supposed to be doing. You know, this is teaching lessons to workers. You were asking, Peter, why does everyone go along with it? How do they get away with it? I believe that one of the answers to that question is to do with the balance of class forces. The working class in this country and across the Western countries has become disorganized and very leaderless. And the ruling class has become very arrogant, thinks it can do anything, feels it doesn't have to even pretend to its population anymore.
And it makes them sloppy.
Because it's the population that, when it's organized, can hold the ruling class to account. It's not this journalist or that journalist. It's the mass of the people behind the journalists.
But don't you think?
I guess that explains how they can keep pulling the chemical weapons farce in Syria.
But don't you, Neil, let me go.
Because they're so brazen, and like you were just saying.
Yeah,
like,
but that's why I said they're so sloppy about it, because they're so arrogant.
They're sloppy because they're arrogant, but in their arrogance, they're teaching workers lessons, and the workers are becoming angry. And they will regret their arrogance, that's for sure.
Neil, what I find really fascinating is that, again, you know, we can use the word empire, we can use the word imperialism, but what would they present to us? For example, they use international law when it's to their advantage. When they say they're breaking, the Iranians broke this treaty and all, which they really just don't. I mean, if you really read the thick description, as we used to say when I was a historian. But international law only applies to their foes. It never applies to their behavior. I mean, it's like the international laws of the sea. The United States is always talking about how China's violating them, but the United States doesn't deign even to sign those agreements. And it doesn't keep its own agreements over and over and over again. I ask Native Americans. They know something about that here. But see, this is the trivialization of international law. We take it very seriously on this panel, and I'm sure in this hall, in this wonderful church. And I think that's when you get this duplicity, because if you, it's like when I did a program, we did many programs on Ukraine, and I got in a lot of trouble from people in this country. When they would talk about the Budapest memorandum about the neutrality of Ukraine and all of that. And so what I would do is I would just bring it into my studio and I'd say, well, have you read clause number 3? I mean, isn't that a gross violation of Ukraine's sovereignty by the United States and particularly the spineless European Union? Okay? But there's always a duplicity there. You have to be law-abiding. We don't have to follow the law, but you must do. And we will use the international law against you. but it's never in the other direction.
Is that for me? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's incredible the number of examples of that we can see all the time, can't we? And we go back to Yugoslavia, we go back to, I mean, I was heavily involved in opposing that military intervention in 1999. The Rubicon was really crossed there, and Yugoslavia was an interesting case because here was a blatant contravention of international law. Yugoslavia wasn't in NATO, it attacked no other state. The war on it was blatantly illegal, and to justify that war, which coincided with the 50th anniversary celebrations, as it was, of NATO, Tony Blair made his famous speech in Chicago when he talked about this doctrine of humanitarian intervention, which
has no basis in international law.
No basis in international law. This was meant to justify what they were doing, what they were bombing Yugoslavia for 78 days during that conflict, including no break over Orthodox Easter. And so I think that was a crucial moment. And if we look back at that, it was fascinating to see that how the left, again, was very divided by that, because, of course, it was a Labour government in Britain which was in power then, which was at the forefront of that. We had the Greens in Germany very strongly in favour. We had French Socialist Party in favour. And so we have this new development of a pro-war, pro-imperialist left, if you can call them a left. The real left, as I like to call them, were out on the streets marching against that war. George Galloway. I think it was only 9 or was it 11 Labour MPs voted against that war. George Galloway was one of them, and the late great Tony Benn was another. And I actually marched with him at the front of that march in London in 1999. So that was interesting. We saw what you would call the centre-left, liberal-left, all were gunning for that war, all were very pro-war. And that's been the problem, because as Jonty was saying, that we're actually in a worse place now, I think, than we were back then, because you did have still a large number of, a reasonably large number of voices in the public sphere who would come out against the war. Just to show you how things have regressed, John Pilger, I don't know if he's here tonight, but John Pilger, we all know and love John Pilger. John Pilger was a regular, he was a columnist on the Daily Mirror. When I was growing up, he was never off the TV. His documentaries were shown prime time. We all watched his documentaries on Vietnam, on Indonesia. Where is he today? You can only see him on RT. Quite astonishing. This guy was mainstream. And so too many other journalists 20, 30 years ago with our views were on regularly on the BBC, on ITV, in the daily newspapers. They've been pushed totally out to what the mainstream people regard as the fringes. So we've actually got worse when we think we had George Galloway in Parliament. Where is he now? He's not in Parliament. And so I think that we're actually, and I don't want to be pessimistic or anything like that, because we've all got to sort of be realistic, that actually in terms of the parameters, the parameters are much narrower now than they were in the 60s or 70s. I've got a large collection of newspapers which I regularly refer to from the 60s, 70s and 80s, and it's amazing to see what people were writing in comment pages, and what people
and
were saying.
And the internet was supposed to be a leveling yeah. field for all voices to participate. It was supposed to be the great democratic experiment. It's turning into the most tyrannical experiment, because it has absolute control. It sees everything, it hears everything, and it can fake everything also. One of the things, and let me go to Mike about this. I think rational thought has been replaced with virtue signaling. Going back to Yugoslavia, that's one of the first times we heard, something must be done. Then you start the roll. Something must be done. Something must be done. Something must be done. And then those in power that have vested interests. Let's, you know, we haven't talked about the arms industry here. You know, and CNN and BBC love war. It's so entertaining. All those wonderful graphics and all those, as NBC said, as they were bombing illegally Syria, those beautiful missiles. Remember that? How revolting that was. Those are beautiful missiles. Not talking about what they're going to hit, okay? Because they don't exist, all right? So virtue signaling has replaced rational thought and debate. I mean, Mike, what do you think about that?
I think regarding virtue signaling, yeah, it's. I mean, it's funny. When you're talking about the narrowing of the conversation, it's like that virtue signaling takes place within this smaller and smaller space, and it becomes more and more, I don't know, I would say ridiculous, you know. A lot of the things that these people are talking about and the arguments that are going on, I mean, as we've been talking about, that we've been, you know, the Iraq war happened, there's been one war after another. I don't know what happened to the anti-war movement. It sort of dissipated after that 2 million man march. It just sort of went, and I suppose what Neil's talking about, that there was this sort of, the left were sort of co-opted, and they became, you know, thinking that they're doing some kind of humanitarian deed, which is a little bit difficult to sort of understand when people are having bombs raining down on their heads and stuff. But I think that, yeah, it gets smaller and smaller, the amount where you're, I mean, I find it almost... You can't have a decent conversation anymore. It's become so small. And they just seem to be mad what they're talking about with all this virtue signaling. I mean, I won't maybe go into any details. But it just seems to be getting more and more constricted, yeah. And more irrelevant. And it's just like a bit of madness, really. I mean, I don't want to make a joke or anything. But it's almost become a bit mad, the things that they're busy with. Yeah, while important issues are going on. I mean, like with Julian Assange, I mean, you know, when do you hear the benefit of what Julian Assange has done for ordinary people in the media? It's just like you're saying, it's, you know, I mean, you know, it's the discussion about him skateboarding, it's discussion about what's on the walls. But what is the benefit of what he's doing and how he's opened that transparent window for the population to see, oh, this is our wonderful elites are spending our tax money. They're doing this, they're doing that. There's a war over here. Oh, it's not for us. No, it's for some other reason. Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. But
no, well, the thing is that I think when you ask this, or, and I think it's a fake a gesture.
It's a mistake.
It sounds like a parking violation.
Unless a country can face that and feel the guilt over that, they will never learn, and they will continue to follow leaders like that, most Americans, into the next adventurous disaster. And again, Assange is persecuted for reporting what they will not report. I'll tell you what they didn't report today in New York and in Washington. This damn hearing, instruction hearing. I got an email from Ray McGovern, said there wasn't one word in the New York Times or the Washington Post today about the hearing of Julian Assange. And you know, Winston Smith's job was to go back into the archives of the Times and fix what happened 5 years ago if they said there was going to be that much wheat grown 5 years ago, and in the five-year plan they didn't do it, just went back and changed the archives. Well, they're changing it in real time now. They're not going back in the archives. They are deleting the most important information and again, burying and covering up and apologizing for the worst crimes and ignoring what's going on to the man who's revealed those crimes more than any other journalist.
Neil, has you know, these elites, they all, I mean, particularly Americans, because they're always leading. They never lead from behind, never. But everything is done in the name of democracy. But their exercise of power with impunity is if this turned democracy into some kind of fake ritual. I mean, we already heard about Brexit. You know, you have a choice, stay or leave. And then for 3 years you just discuss, you know, what remain and leave. I don't know, I'm, I, don't think I'm a stupid person. I understand the difference between the two words, okay? No, the thing is that the elites don't trust democracy. They don't trust us, okay? And what's, like I said, is that that's the only thing we're left. That's the only power that they leave us. And they want to leverage that as well, to scare us, to belittle us, to wipe us off the electoral rolls, which is a real favorite one. But everybody does it. I mean, not just one side, okay? But, I mean, these still are elites that don't trust the people's will.
Yeah, and I think that's come, as Jody said, the last 5 years have been a real case study, really, of how the limitations of democracy today in Britain, because we saw with the with the Brexit vote, we had this campaign basically to prevent it happening, and with Jeremy Corbyn's election, how that struck terror into the heart. Well, at the beginning, it struck terror into the hearts of the establishment. Theresa May, I think, in Parliament actually said, you know, he won't be allowed, or worse to that effect, he won't be allowed to become Prime Minister, and that was the case. He wasn't going to be allowed to become Prime Minister, and because he, on a number of key foreign policy issues, and I do not believe that the reason he wasn't allowed to become Prime Minister was because he wanted to nationalise the railways. I want to nationalise the railways. I'm the director of the Campaign for Public Ownership. But I don't think it was those issues really that did it. It was his foreign policy background, his anti-war activism, his anti-imperialism. Yeah. Yeah. It was his Palestinian, pro-Palestinian activism. Was his stop the war activism. These were the no-go areas. These were no-goes. There was no way somebody with his background in that kind of activism was going to be allowed to become British Prime Minister, especially when his Director of Communications was a man called Seamus Milne, a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. Look at his journalism. Look at what he was writing 10 years ago. And you can understand why the neocon establishment, the pro-war establishment, the endless war establishment were going to do all they could to destroy that possibility. Well,
they couldn't allow a Trotskyite at 10
well,
Downing,
it,
right?
Well, okay. They weren't going to allow anybody with that kind of background of imprinting imperialism. And I think going back to Corbyn, it's fascinating, isn't it? Jeremy Corbyn, in 2017... he came under the radar. He was 20% down in the polls, if you can remember that election. The establishment, I think, were pretty confident they thought Labour would get routed. And to their horror, on election night, do you remember that exit poll? And it said, we have a hung parliament. And it was even an hour or two during that evening when Labour looked like they could actually win the election. And they were never going to make, they were never going to allow that to happen again. So we had, and the key way in which the project was destroyed was from within the Labour Party itself. Not by the Conservatives. We all knew that they were going to oppose Labour, obviously. It was more, the damage was done by the pro-war, the endless war, the liberal interventionists, whatever you want to call them, the Blairites. These were the people who destroyed that project, and that needs to be understood, that the Labour Party... is not, I'm afraid, a party that we show it from Corbyn, cannot deliver, I think, a genuinely different kind of foreign policy. And isn't it interesting? I tend to think, anybody remember that Doctor Who episode from the early 70s, one of the John Pertwee ones, when these aliens actually have a dastardly plan to capture British politicians and replace them with clones? I got a theory that that happened to Jeremy Corbyn in between 2017 and 2019. Because Jeremy Corbyn, instead of being the Jeremy Corbyn that we knew and loved on the anti-war platforms, he got all serious, he put those glasses on his nose, and he started talking about constitutionalism and, you know, the terrible things that the government was doing, trying to get Brexit through, all that kind of thing. He was becoming so establishment, and he was hemorrhaging votes all the time. He was losing votes, and what happened last year was like watching a car crash in slow motion. We all knew that Labour was going to lose the election because he didn't fight back against the smears, and he went for that second referendum policy. But final point, isn't it interesting that as soon as the election was over, the old Jeremy Corbyn comes back? He's speaking out about Julian Assange. He was brilliant over the New Year about the attacks on Iran and about the threats made against Iran and the assassination of Soleimani. This is like the old Jeremy Corbyn was allowed back in.
But it's happening again. I don't know. I don't know if you follow here on this wonderful island, the American presidential primaries. But the app that was used in the Iowa caucus. Oops. Okay. I mean, again, you have within the ranks of the party itself, the establishment, that will not allow the people's will to be heard, okay? Now, was it a glitch? I don't know. But, I mean, certainly it should open your imagination of trying to understand something of that. I mean, they had 4 years to get ready for it, okay? Oh, but it was the Hillary Clinton people that were connected to the people with the apps. And the Buttigieg here.
But don't you think, Peter, about Trump? Can I just start to say about Trump? Because when Trump got elected, there were a lot of people who thought this is going to be, he's going to bring the troops back home, he's going to be take on the neocons.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up. Because yeah. You know, I was saying earlier, on the sidelines here, I mean, and what I'm about to say might be very controversial, but I want you to give it a thought. I mean, Donald Trump is a dream for the deep state, okay? He does what they say, okay? He really does. The whole thing with Syria, you know. I mean, again, you know, you have to separate the tweets from the policy, okay? Okay, now they've done a cleaning out of the National Security Council. I doubt that's going to happen. We have the new anonymous sources coming out. It's never going to stop, okay? Now, Trump is a very controversial person, okay? And I'm a conservative. I don't see him as a conservative, and I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump. However, I do support policy. If he does something that I think is good for anti-war, anti-imperialism, I'm going to agree with it. His record in doing that is very short, okay? And that record is essentially rhetorical at this point here. I mean, the only reason why he hasn't gone along with the Israeli lobby and the neocons in Washington to attack Iran is because he made a campaign promise not to start a new war. He does take that seriously. He doesn't want a new war before the election. That doesn't say anything about after the election, all right? And we have to keep our eye on that. But my whole point is here is that even if there is a public expression through the ballot box, there's so many. What was it the former head of the no, it was Chuck Schumer that said about the FBI, they have seven ways to Sunday to get you. And that stands, okay? And I think he's one of the FBI. No, he's a member of the Gang of Eight, okay? So he should know. Go ahead.
No, he said the intelligence agencies have seven ways to Sunday to get back at you. What kind of a statement is a senator making on national television?
And he's a member of what's called the Gang of Eight, the eight Congress people that are informed about what's going on in the intelligence.
He was admitting right there, Peter, that the president does not have the power that one thinks, that there is the intelligence agencies that have more power. Trump may leave in November. At the NSA, Tom Drake told me, they say administrations come and go. We're always going to be here. And Chuck Schumer confirmed that. Now, I want to say about Sanders. First of all, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair in this country and Clinton in the U.S. destroyed any idea of a left.
Yep.
There is no left, at least in America. There's no organized left. It's center-right party. The Clintons are center right. That's where the Labor Party under the Blairites are, and certainly the American Democratic Party under Clinton. Bernie Sanders is an FDR Democrat. He's not really a great leftist. He's not really social. He doesn't want to nationalize key industry, as once happened in this country, where you had industries nationalizing. He's not talking about that. He's talking about bringing back FDR, which is an improvement over what's going on right now. So I think about a month ago, the intelligence agencies had said, they briefed him, sat him down and said, Russia's, we got evidence Russia's helping you. Now, I don't know what they discussed. Maybe he said, well, show me the evidence. Well, a month later, this thing is leaked to the Washington Post. If the intelligence agencies
before the Nevada primary.
Right, the day before. If the intelligence services really were there to protect the citizens, that's what they say they're doing, right? Then they would have briefed him.
No, it's the integrity of the democratic process.
Okay. Yeah, of course.
No, well, because the deep state can meddle, and that's real. But Russian meddling is an illusion.
They would have just quietly briefed him and given him the evidence. Instead, we get it leaked on the front page of the Washington Post. And then there's the sentence, how it happened, how the Russians did that, is not clear. There was no evidence. an old-style newspaper, a news editor would say, well, we're not running this story until you find out what it is, what the facts are. Just don't run. But they ran the story because they're sucking up to power. And here Sanders had a choice. Do I go public? Now I got to say something now. Do I say, well, where's the evidence that they did this? We don't have any evidence. He would be seen as being disloyal to the intelligence services and by default a puppet of the Kremlin. So he goes and bashes Russia. So now they got him on the record. If he gets elected, they got him on the record. He's not going to be for detente. He's got to be against Russia too. Maybe they said you could have your single payer health care and all that crap. Just don't talk about being friendly to Russia.
But that's short. I mean, that is that's meddling with the democratic process, and it's quite open, and we all know
absolutely
it right now.
They did it in many foreign countries with regime change over the years and coups, and they do it at home. Looks like.
Okay.
All right. I'll second that.
What happened to the left? Give me why. Because here we go. I knew you were going to do this. Okay. We're going to wait here. We're going to Tony, wait just for a second. Okay. Just for a second. Okay.
My case, you know.
You should be in jail. Okay.
You know, I just want to say a few words. I've been criticized. You know, I've just come here and I've heard my name said I destroy the left and all that kind of thing. I just want to say a few words about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and why it's, you know...
Get the mic closer.
I think Julian Assange has got to stay in jail, you know. Now, why do I say that? Because, you know, he makes it more difficult for people like me to operate. Because if people are reading about, you know, war crimes committed by the US and its allies, it's going to be much harder to sell the wars. I mean, look at Iraq. I mean, I've heard people criticizing the Iraq war. I can't think why. You know, we went into Iraq to liberate the Iraqi people, okay? We called it Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. That was the acronym. That's what it was all about. So, you know, when I hear people say that we've got to, you know, release Julian Assange, just imagine if we did that. Just imagine if Julian Assange was allowed to walk free tomorrow. He'd be back at WikiLeaks revealing what we've been doing in Syria, what we've been doing in Libya, all that stuff. And who's that going to benefit? Who's that going to benefit? It's going to be to the detriment of people like me. And people like my friend Bill Clinton and Donald Trump and all these people. So in the interests of liberation of people, liberation of countries from their assets and things like this, it's absolutely imperative, I think, that Julian Assange is extradited to the US, where he'll get a very fair trial, because I'll be the judge, and put away 475 years. I think that would be liberal democracy, freedom, and democracy in action. So, yeah.
Okay, know. All right.
Any more questions?
All right. I want to do this the last round here, and I want to go to each person here.
Thank you.
Take the mask off. Okay.
where
do we go from here? Because I think we've done a very good job of describing what is going on. But what can we do, the people in this wonderful church? How do we move forward? Start at the end. Go ahead.
How do we move forward? I think one thing with regards to Jeremy Corbyn and also what's brought up about Bernie Saunders is, which I thought was a very good point, that once he agreed to the Russiagate thing, they've sort of got him then, and they can come back and they can pile on the pressure. But I had the feeling with Jeremy Corbyn, if he'd stuck to his, you know, being honest, I guess, being truthful, that has quite a power. He came when he first came into British politics, like Neil was saying. It wasn't just that; it was a big wave, like you were saying about the populism, and he was riding that wave, and everybody was up for it. And there were a lot of different types of people from all different, you know, I don't know about right, left, you know, far left. I mean, they call them far left now. I don't know what the far left is. It seems to have become something so unpleasant in the mainstream media. But they're part of society, and all these different groups were all sort of rising up on it. And it was a shame that he seemed to think, we're getting close, you know, we could be in power, better not do that. And he suddenly started sort of reverting his behaviour to what he thinks is going to get him elected. And I don't know if he just stuck and been, you know, a bit outrageous and said things.
I
don't know whether he would have won, but at least he would have gone down with a good
ship. I'm a little bit more
ship,
sympathetic,
you know?
Because I think there are structural issues that make that happen. But I agree with you. But I think there are structural issues that force him to do that.
For me, when somebody is honest, that touches you and that, you know, that inspires you, you know. So people doing that.
Yeah. Well, there's one person.
I mean, there's obviously a lot.
There's one person sitting in prison that does inspire us all.
Absolutely, Julian. Yeah.
Go ahead, Neil. Go ahead.
I agree totally with Mike. And just to quickly back that up, I knew a number of people, conservatives, who said they were going to vote for Jeremy Corbyn in 2017 because they thought he was the most honest guy out. And in 2019, they said, "What a flip flop! What a flip flop this guy is! What a weak guy he is! He's allowed Chris Williamson to be suspended, Ken Livingstone to be thrown under the bus." They lost respect for him. And that's the thing that Mike said, you can't, you know, sincerity, you can't fake it. Jeremy Corbyn had it, and look, the amazing wave of popularity, he rode that populist wave. And the minute you start to think, I'm going to play safe and drop this, drop that, stay silent on Assange, don't talk about this, don't talk about Syria, don't talk about Libya, you're dead politically. And so I think that honesty is needed, but to be honest, you need enormous courage. And I think what we tend to forget is that we are the many, they are the few, to use a Labour slogan that's got a bit hackneyed, but it's true. The people that we're talking about who actually operate this system are numerically very small. There are a very small number of people. We are millions and millions and millions of us. They don't represent us. We had this absurd situation just a month ago in London when we had a man who had been in the same high security jail as Julian, who was released even though he was quite openly talking about carrying out attacks against civilians. He had a knife rampage in Streatham, and this was the guy who the authorities allowed onto the streets of London, whereas Julian Assange is kept as if the man is a huge public danger. It's a numbers game. Jodie hit the nail on the head too when she said that what's happened is that we've allowed, I'm afraid, a number of things to divide us, ID politics being the number one. This business about fighting battles about sexual issues and about whether we're Jewish, whether we're Muslim, whether we're Hindu, whatever. These stuff divides us. If only we were able to understand that, to understand that while we're all arguing about toilet signage or whatever it is, they are counting the money. They're getting richer. It's fascinating to think that the world's very richest people the last decade got even richer, phenomenally rich. I think you can put half the richest 23 people in the world now own more than half the wealth of this planet. And it's going on and on and on, while in the meantime we're fighting on Twitter about the language we use. We're having people being kicked out or suspended from parties because of tweets 8 years ago they put out because they used the wrong term that's now not acceptable. That's where we allowed ourselves to get dragged into.
But that's all
instead of focusing on the key and the most important issues.
It's intentional.
Sorry, intentional.
Evan.
Well, I would speak from a media perspective. I would say that, you know, well, Neil, you were saying years ago, these establishment papers were actually putting out good content, and now they're putting out absolute garbage, you know. But on the other hand, there probably isn't one person on this panel who hasn't been smeared in some way or form, right? And we've gotten used to it. But the thing is, the things that we've been saying and contesting, more and more people now are saying the same things. So I think that, I guess the takeaway would be to persevere in the face of whatever smears you're going to be facing, whether you're like a new journalist or you're in politics or whatever, just to persevere. Because if you're standing with the truth, and
we were all talking about integrity and honesty actually showing and shining through. If you're standing with the truth and you persevere, then eventually people will recognize it. So
I remember the first five hate mails. I remember the first five death threats. I don't remember the last 1,500, though. Get used to it. Yeah.
And look at RT. Look at where RT started and where it is now, right? And look how demonized Russian media has been, and yet more and more people are turning to it because it offers a platform of opinions and views that cannot be heard in Western corporate media.
Well, you know, it was after the collective wisdom of the intelligence community, the report, what was it, in January 2017, It was 25 pages long, 4 pages were blank, and 13 pages were on RT. Wow. Thank you, intelligence community. You helped my guest list immensely, okay? They put us on the map. No, you're right. It has a boomerang. All of this stuff has a boomerang effect. Sometimes shorter, sometimes longer, but it does come back.
You know, we're talking about where do we go from here, and Eva's pinpointed the importance of an independent media. We've all been talking about that tonight. And the importance, as Mike was saying, of honesty. You know, we need to rebuild our organisation from the bottom up. We have allowed our organisations to be subverted, to become a controlled opposition. Every opposition, official opposition movement in this country now has its aims put at the service of the Labour Party electoral machine, and anything that they think doesn't help them get elected, including an opinion of any of its leaders, gets put down. You know, we recently held a meeting. I'm part of the newly formed Workers' Party. We're exactly trying to address this issue, that there isn't an independent working class voice, there isn't an independent working class media in this country. We need to rebuild. We need to start again. That's just a fact. But we need a leadership that isn't scared. We need a leadership that doesn't say what's electable, but what is true. Not what is electable. Because who decides what's electable? It's the state machine that says this far and no further. This is how things are, and if you want to come in, if you want to join the club, you have to do it our way. You have to be our man. But we need leaders who don't want to run their system. We need leaders who want to speak for us and represent us, because it is us or them. We can't run their system and make it work for us. We need a system that works for workers.
Peter, many of your viewers have told you countless times that your show should be more than half an hour. So you got it tonight. You got it tonight. You got an hour. About being smeared. Yes, everybody's been smeared here. We're all smeared. Bob Perry, who founded Consortium News, was smeared because he was one of the first and leading skeptics of Russiagate.
And one of the greatest journalists of his generation.
Absolutely. And we gave Julian... Bob Perry created the Gary Webb Freedom of Press Award, and I just presented it to Kristen Hafenson, the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, the other day. We gave that award to Julian Assange this year. But there are smears and then there are smears, you know. Most of you brush them off. But in December, the Communication Security Establishment, which is the NSA of Canada, the GCHQ of Canada, the Cryptological Electronic Agency, issued a report that was broadcast on the major television network Global News, saying that Russia was conducting a cyber attack campaign in Canada against Canadian politicians, and Consortium News was in the lead and directed by Russia. So we are taking legal action against that intelligence agency and that television network. We sent libel notices from a lawyer in Toronto. They refused to apologize and retract. They never contacted us to get a comment before the publication. It was kind of journalism 101. They put an editor's note at the bottom, which we rejected, saying what we should have said before. So that's we're not going to take that kind of smear anymore. About how to move forward, how to answer your question, as you were saying, I think with the destruction of any kind of genuine left parties by Clinton in the Democratic Leadership Council and New Labour with Blair, this vacuum is here. Obviously, there needs to be an organization on the left in the U.S. create a genuine left-wing party somehow. If Sanders loses, maybe there'll be a chance that something like that could happen.
Well, I mean, if they steal it from him, it will break the Democratic
Absolutely.
Party. And actually, it will be a good thing. It will be a good thing, okay? Because, again, speaking as a conservative, you know, people, I surprise people all the time. In 2016, there were only two candidates in the American presidential election that I watched, Trump and Sanders. Those are the only two. And they're the only
and they're trying to destroy both of them. Again,
now they're trying, they're trying to destroy both of them simultaneously.
That's right.
Okay? And, I do think that charisma is very important and that authenticity is very important. And for better or worse, and I'm sure for this crowd, worse, Donald Trump is an authentic character. But so is Bernie Sanders to a great degree within the confines of the American political system. Okay, every place is a little bit different. But it is his authenticity that really scares people in power, and particularly his own party. Well, he's an independent, but is running as a Democrat here. So, Any other comments before we wrap up?
Yeah, just and the second thing beside organizing is to save the media, free Julian Assange, bring back that voice to do the job the mainstream media does not do.
On that note, thank you very much.
Could we have George Galloway up here as well, and Craig Murray, if he's about, please. And
one, two.
Yes, we can have a Q&A for maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. So, and Alexander McCurris as well, if he's, yep. Come on. Right. First of all, if anybody has a question, but particularly a question that has that challenges what they've heard tonight, I mean, don't want to hear monologues where people are talking for 2-3 minutes about what they agree with. We want maybe prefer to hear people that want to challenge. Who wants to challenge?
Is it empire, imperialism, or global fascism we are living under?
Just before Peter answers that, we will have, after the Q&A, we'll be having Mike Barson and Mike's brother Ben and Yasin going to perform three or four songs. Okay. So if you could all hang around, there'll be a bit of music.
Okay, I didn't really want to go into kind of a definitional exercise with empire and imperialism, and I think it would be a fascinating panel to have about that. But see, I look at the real toxicity as neoliberalism as an ideology, and it has become messianic. Now, we had Tony Blair on the panel for a short... Hang on, Tony. Back. You know, people say Iraq was all about oil. No, it wasn't. It was partly about oil.
Operation Iraqi Liberation.
Partly. But it's part of an ideology that does not allow dissent. That's why in my presentation I said a regime change has come home. It wasn't that case before, but over and over again we have regime change because it has a messianic intolerance of anyone that will not, or any country that will not take the knee, or an individual like Julian Assange that won't take the knee. So I feel it's even worse. That's why I don't use the word imperialism, because it's even worse than imperialism. Because if we take like a 19th century definition of imperialism, then you're looking at just like profits and plundering and all that, which of course that's part of regime change as well. But for me, it's far more toxic and far, because you're dealing with people that are ideologically possessed. And how do you interact with someone that is ideologically possessed? I mean, what do you do? And do you go to Helsinki and have a conference with the devil himself? No, you don't.
That's what makes it far worse. And that's why I was very careful in not kind of pinning down empire and imperialism, because I think we need to have a really deep discussion. Really what we have, the poverty of the situation for all of us, as a conservative, as a communist, would you call yourself? Sure, okay. But it's not the difference. My conservatism and your communism is not what separates us, per se, at all. Because we have the same interest. We talked about the working class incessantly during lunch. We may have different ways of getting there, but we have the same goal. But when you have an ideology that is, it doesn't allow any form of interrogative, that's the bad situation we're at. You know, what are they going to do to Bernie?
He's a communist.
He likes Cuba. He had his honeymoon in the Soviet Union. What does that have to do with anything about healthcare in America? It has nothing to do with it. It's the virtue signaling that we talked about. Because they won't talk about issues that affect everyone in this hall, in this wonderful church. They have to talk about things that are completely, I don't even give a second thought. Things, they make us think about things that I would never think about except for I'm told to think about it. That's the identitarian politics issue, which is a complete... I'm sorry, I did study communism quite well when I was in graduate school. That's a false consciousness. It's very true.
That's not what we do.
Okay. All right, we can have our own little battle at another time.
No, this next question.
Who is actually behind the persecution of Assange? Clearly not the political puppets that we have. Clearly not the judiciary that now is in bed with them. But who are these people? Who are these dark forces? And it's not just Assange, it's so many others.
So who is behind the persecution of Assange? Well, not so many people, but ultimately those people who have power in the United States, primarily in Britain also. And I suppose we have to talk about what we call the military-industrial complex, the regime change lobby, the neoconservatives, those sort of people. The people who have, let's be very clear about it, an ideology, a belief that the world should be conducted in the way that they want it to be conducted, and who are becoming, and have the, indeed they do, they have the power to do it, and they're centralizing that power all the time, and they're becoming more and more intolerant of the dissent that they encounter, and of the resistance they encounter, and they don't want us to see that, you know, the sort of discussions they have with each other. And, you know, one mustn't perhaps be naive about this. I think these people are very conscious about what they're doing. We've seen this happen in many situations around the world and in the United States, that they make their decisions very carefully. They think through very carefully what they do, and they're very organized about how they do
them. I'll give you some names. I'll give you some names. Mike Pompeo, former CIA director. Joe Biden, who called Assange a high-tech terrorist. Gina Haspel, CIA director now, and the Trump Justice Department that indicted him.
Anybody else want to field that question? That was a good question. George.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Along with my comrade Jyoti, I don't shirk from using the word imperialism, though we can call it empire if we can include Peter in our midst, because it isn't just the United States. I mean, just this evening, Keir Starmer, the next leader of the Labour Party, who's deeply implicated and complicit in the persecution of Julian Assange, has attacked Corbyn and MacDonald for their belated support for Julian Assange. The Swedish authorities were complicit in the persecution of Julian Assange. The Australian authorities, who until now at least have sat on their hands, in the face of the persecution of one of their own citizens are part of this conspiracy. So the way I look at it around the world, and I include the British government in that and previous British governments, it's the empire. It's neither Labour nor Tory, nor Democrat nor Republican, because it doesn't seem to matter which of these parties is in power. The interests of the empire prevail. Now, actually, I wholeheartedly agree with Peter Lavelle, with respect, Mr. Blair. The invasion of Iraq was not just about oil. It was not just about Israel, though it was undoubtedly, in part, both of those things. The invasion of Iraq, which Julian did so much to help discredit, was about the demonstration of the hegemony, the dominance of the empire, the neoliberal orthodoxy, where you have capitalist economics at home and imperial domination of other countries abroad. And that exists on both sides of the aisle, as they put it, and in all Western countries to one extent or another. That's why I'm glad Gregor called this evening imperialism on trial. It's better to put imperialism on trial than Julian Assange on trial.
Hi, thank you. The reason I think there is this great confusion between left and right coming out is that the context here is millennial, and it's much more calamitous than that, and nobody's hooked onto it. It is the fight, the ancient fight between the old regime, where the ruler can get at whoever he wants with impunity, and the modern form that we've tried to establish over a few hundred years only, where you have a constitution that brings the ruler under the rule of law. But for that to work, it's the obligation of every man and woman to report crime to his fellows. And in exchange for that obligation, it is the duty of society to protect the person enacting that from being got at by the criminal. Now, what's happened at an absolute squeak is that the people who have thirst for the old regime, and they are amongst us, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask if they will endorse this. I'm really trying to, well, I don't know how to put this question in that case. Do you agree that we have to have a constitution that makes it illegal for anybody to hide crime behind secrecy, and that it must be the case that anybody performing the duty of exposing crime must be permitted to break that secrecy to report crime to the nation? Otherwise, the old regime endures and smuggles its way past into the new. Do you agree?
Brilliant question.
Can I come in, Greg?
Judy, yep. Judy.
With the best will in the world and the greatest of respect to the comrade in the audience who asked this question, I think it's the wrong question. You can write any rule book you like. We could sit here and come up with the perfect rule book. We could impose, we could have it agreed on by voted, all the people accept it. If you have a society where a few people control all the wealth, because it's a society based on capitalist exploitation, a class society where there's a tiny minority who have the wealth and the power, it doesn't matter what the rules are, the rules will never apply to the people in power. You cannot hold power to account when power and money are vested in a tiny handful of people. It isn't possible. You have to change the system if you want equality, if you want fairness, if you want the rule of law, if you want any of the things you're talking about. If you want peace, if you want jobs, if you want homes, if you want security, if you want pensions, if you want fairness in international relations, you can't have this system. You know, we started the French Revolution, the American Revolution started with these lovely principles of equality and fraternity, but the capitalist system has an inevitable development that got us from there to here. If we try and go back to there, we'll end up here.
Can I just add a quick point to that, what we haven't mentioned tonight, I don't think, is it's no coincidence how the last 25, 30 years has seen war after war, regime change war, and millions of people killed, the so-called war on terror, the toppling of governments around the world by the US. The key factor, the key historical point we've got to mention is what happened in 1989 and 90. Yes. Without a doubt, the fall of the Soviet Union, the ending of the communist, I don't like to say the word bloc, but the communist countries in Europe, Eastern Europe, undoubtedly ushered in a new period of lawlessness, international brigandry, international lawlessness, the project for the new American century. The neocons saw the end of the Soviet Union as a great opportunity to basically colonize the rest of the world. Julian Assange's plight, I think, is linked to that. For 20 years, Russia was in free fall, or 15 years under free fall under Yeltsin, and that was a tragic period, I think, not just for the Russian people who saw a catastrophic fall in their living standards, but internationally. That period started with the bombing of Yugoslavia, gone to Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Only in the last few years have we seen the start of a counterweight to that with the return of Russia and, to a lesser extent, internationally, China. And that, of course, is why Russia is so demonized, why there have been so many attempts to get RT off the air in the UK and in other countries too. So I think that, you know, when we're discussing what's been happening, I don't think we can ignore the largely negative impact internationally of what happened in 1989. And in fact, you don't have to be a communist or a leftist or a socialist to go along with this. In the Sunday Telegraph in 1990, Peregrine Wursthorn, who is I think he's 95 or 96 now, he was the doyen of conservative commentators in Britain. He was a high Tory. You couldn't imagine a more high Tory than Peregrine Wursthorn. He actually, in all the euphoria that was around in 89, people saying how fantastic it was, we're going to have the peace dividend, NATO was going to disband, we're all going to join hands and have a wonderful world. Peregrine Wursthorn said actually that he feared for the future what would happen, because from now on the US would have nobody to restrain it, and he feared what was happening. And he was proven as a conservative realist to be 100% correct in what had happened. And so I think that's a very important point to make.
Right. Our fourth question here.
Hi. The position of a journalist is to educate themselves in public. And do you think that we've now reached an age where we have people like the owner of Amazon, who now owns the Washington Post, in now positions where journalism is something of the past, real journalism is something of the past? And where do we move forward if Assange is sent to America, which is probably going to happen, if we're realistic about it? Unfortunately, so. Where do we go in journalism? Everyone's looking at me like I'm mad, but how do we fight back?
Well, we must all become journalists. You've got an example here. He's got a publication. Peter Lavelle is working on RT. I'm working on RT. Neil is writing for RT. Eva is doing everything that she can with our Patreon page. We must be citizen journalists. And we must stop buying the press, which is doing its best to lie to us and turn us against each other. In my opinion, I know it's a criminal offence, but I don't know why anyone pays their BBC licence fee in order to be lied to. Even Stalin never thought of sending people to jail if they didn't pay him for Russian TV propaganda. But that's what we're doing. We'll get fined £1,000, and if we don't pay the £1,000, they'll add the court costs, and if we don't pay that, they'll send us to prison. If we don't pay for a British state broadcaster whose job is to lie to us. So I believe we must all search. You know, ignorance is self-inflicted now. We have the ability to find the truth. With a few clicks on the computer or the phone, we can find alternative media that's telling us the truth. You can find the Duran. You can find the 21st Century Wire. You can watch Peter Lavelle on RT. You can do it, and we must do it, and we must become evangelists for it, I say, in this hallowed place. We must proselytize the iniquities of what passes for journalism in our country and proselytize for its alternatives.
I just want to add that, you know, we've talked about journalists being smeared or publications being smeared, but now it's almost every single independent publication or journalist who are being smeared, even to the extent that the OPCW, some might call them whistleblowers, the people that have spoken out about the discrepancies or the falsities of the OPCW report, they are being smeared. Or mainstream journalists are being smeared because they question the OPCW report. But what I was going to say when we were talking earlier is that they're afraid of us. That's why they're smearing us. And we don't give a shit. Pardon my language, but I don't care if they smear us. And that's why they're afraid.
We have to recognize that the people who are being targeted must be doing something right, and that therefore it's a badge of honor. We won't be intimidated. We will keep on making our voices heard, and we will build bigger, louder voices. We have to have our own separate media, because the mainstream, the official, the imperialist, the corporate media will never represent us, will never tell us the truth. We should stop expecting it to.
This is your future, Mr. Blair. Sorry. Yeah, just about what George was saying as well about the mainstream media. I was on LBC Radio last night speaking to Ian Dale, and he'd never seen the video that Chelsea Manning put out when a caller reminded him. To be fair to him, he spoke to me for about 10 minutes, and he was quite reasonable. But I think, you know, we've got to speak to these echo chambers and not become our own echo chamber. So I'd like everyone to call up these radio stations. But I just wonder, I'm just asking the panel, has any of you been on any mainstream channel this week about Julian Assange?
Very, very good question there. Who wants to field that? Maybe perhaps somebody that hasn't fielded one so far.
I've been on LBC Radio about Julian Assange, and on RT and RT Francais.
Okay. And I'm flying out early tomorrow morning, and on Thursday I'm making a program about what we've said and heard tonight, and it'll be on air on Friday.
Anybody else want to answer that question, or shall we move on to the next question? Right. Right.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you. Mostly for Eva and the other panelists. Thank you for all the independent journalism that we've had coming from Syria the last few years. It's been incredibly important. You know, because in my lifetime, the reporting from Syria, if we were to believe the mainstream media narrative, the people that they are telling us are the good guys and the bad guys is completely reversed. And they're telling us that people like Jabhat al-Nusra are the good people. You know, so thank you for everybody. You know, so One of the positive things in the last few years, as Syria becomes terrorist-free, it's becoming apparent that the stories that you were reporting years ago that we were told were mad conspiracy theories, these are in fact the truth. So what happens to the respectable journalists, the ones who reported from Beirut and from Istanbul, and do you ever come into contact with any of them? And what do they say to you? Do they show any remorse? And for the future, what it is that, what should we do? Should we be boycotting these medias? And just interested in your thoughts. Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment as opposed to ask a question specifically. With regard to the way out of this, I think there's a fundamental problem of paradigm amongst the educated classes in this country. For what makes that obvious is that the case of Julian Assange is clearly a case of going against a long tradition that goes right back to Magna Carta, habeas corpus, all sorts of basic human rights, that the educated classes, why are they not here? Why are not all the people from the universities, not just the journalists? I mean, we talked about the corruption of journalists, but I'm talking about this general view in British society that somehow this doesn't matter because they don't get what's going on. Now, the question is, why don't they get what's going on? I think that relates to something that Neil Clark and George Galloway were talking about, where people, I think they think that the neoliberal dominance of the world is the only game in town. This is the thing. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union and an alternative way of doing things, which, in my opinion, needed to collapse, it's like there is no other alternative. So, therefore, the Western liberal model that has degenerated into a neoliberal model must be the prevailing game in town. And this is what we need to push back against. And eventually, if you start to persuade people that there may be alternatives, then you can change things.
I have an answer. I think that's a very good observation. You know why they think the neoliberal model should be unchallenged? It's because it works for them. They never feel the consequences of their own policies. They're insulated from it, and they're insulated from their own deceit. Okay, they don't have to look at themselves. Okay, and they certainly will not be questioned by plebs like ourselves, okay? Because they have no respect for anyone outside of, and now I'm going to genuflect over here, to their own class interests, okay? They will never do that. And they've been able to insulate themselves because they've captured the judiciary, captured the media. You have the corporate world playing a game of a shell game. Look over there, identity politics, identitarian politics. Don't look over there, okay? Because that's where my vested interests are, okay? It's really quite simple, okay? And the internet just jazzes it all up. You have all these whistles and bells to keep everyone focused on everything else that is important. And that's how they do it. They never suffer the consequences of their own policies. So never listen to what they have to say about immigration, about health care, education. They're all set, okay? I mean, these people are so well set, they're set for their great-grandchildren, okay? And they want to keep it that way, and they will fight to keep it that way.
I just wanted to respond to something that Neil Clark said. You wondered if John Pilger was in the House. He is not. John Pilger has gone to Australia. He spoke tonight in Sydney, fighting for Julian on the ground.
Right. This is my good friend, Fra Hughes, from Belfast. Fra spoke at the last imperialism on trial event in Derry. Fra is a tireless campaigner. He's been to Syria, or he's been first to Palestine on a flotilla along with George. He's been to Syria a couple of times, once or twice, five times to Syria, Fra, jeepers. And the Donbass, most recently, the Donbass and Venezuela as well.
Bravo de fra. So.
Thank you very much for the great introduction. I just wanted to say I've heard an awful lot about Julian Assange tonight, and I think it's very important that we couple Julian Assange with the Chelsea Manning campaign, because there you can't have one without the other. One's in jail protecting the other, one's incarcerated, refusing to bring the other one false evidence to bring him in front of the courts. But we're talking about neoliberalism, and there were people here from Belgium and people here from France from the LFS movement, and it's fantastic that they've been at Belmarsh prison. Is there a kickback from the public now across Western Europe and across the world against neoliberalism? In Ireland, we've had a two-party state for over 100 years until the recent elections, and now Sinn Féin, who I'm not a fan of, have broken that electoral duopoly. Are we witnessing people in the streets saying they've had enough of austerity, enough of neoliberalism, and is there some way we can pull that all together going forward?
Yeah. Well, the ruling elite in Ireland is in a state of petrification at the dramatic rise of Sinn Féin, echoing many of the anti-neoliberal policies that are heard on the streets of France every Saturday, and increasingly in general strikes and all kinds of uproar in France. Big parties, as the French Socialists and the Greek Socialists, PASOK, and I suspect Keir Starmer's Labour Party, big parties can become small parties very quickly. And I'm hoping, and so is Jyoti, that small parties can become big parties very quickly. Also, I was a supporter of Sinn Féin when you could have fitted all of their supporters in Britain in one pub at least. In one pub. One bar in the pub. But now, Sinn Féin are the power in Ireland, North and South. So things can change, Fra. And they're changing for the same reason. And Peter Lavelle put his finger on it in his speech from the lectern. People want control of their own lives. They want a measure of control over how long they have to work, what hours they can work, what wages they can earn, what the future of their children will be, and the system we have denies them that control. And it's our task to unite people in defense of basic interests. For me, that's what Brexit was about. It was a necessary but not sufficient condition to take back control into our own hands, our destiny into our own hands, at least potentially. But if I may just, while I have the microphone, refer to an earlier question. I think our friend, who made a very, very good contribution, was being too kind. It's not that they don't get it. They've got it all right. They understand. If you say to me that journalists in Britain don't know that they're on the side of Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria, I don't believe you. I believe that they know it. They know it. They're bound to know it. I left school at 16 and I know it. They went to Oxford University. They must know it. They, for the reasons Peter said, they support the system we have because they're doing very well out of it. And their children and even their grandchildren now are set up for a jolly good future. And they know that there's only, at this point in time, one show in town, and that's the neoliberal show. So they have sucked on the teat until it bleeds, and they will not let it go, because they're getting fat on it.
Would Jyoti field that question as well from Fra about Sinn Féin's rise in the recent elections and fight against neoliberalism?
So Fra was asking about Is the rise of Sinn Féin in across Ireland a sign that the duopoly, the establishment, the status quo everywhere is under attack and can be defeated? And I think the short answer is yes. I'll give a slightly more complicated answer now. When it comes to the rise of Sinn Féin in Ireland, I think actually it's one of the fantastic side effects of the Brexit vote. I, for one, am very, very happy to see, finally, the prospect of a reunited Ireland is galloping towards us and has been massively accelerated since the Brexit vote happened, and that's a wonderful side effect. But there's something else that's happening around the world. Well, you talked about this duopoly. Everywhere, in every capitalist country almost, you see this Tweedledum and Tweedledee game that gets played, the left and the right, the two parties who have these fake debates and controversies amongst themselves and argue on the head of the pin, and the media's full of what they're arguing about. But they really play a game of passing the power between themselves whilst carrying out the programme of the ruling class. And that is what we see everywhere, but that is actually coming under threat. And one of the ways you can tell it's coming under threat at this time, and there's a crisis everywhere, you can see the ruling classes in all the capitalist countries are fighting with one another. How do they survive the crisis? One of the things that's terrifying them is that despite the fact that we in the alternative media are so small, they are desperate to silence our voice. They're desperate because people are starting to hear truths that make sense to them, and it's giving them ideas. It's giving them a thirst for organisation, a thirst for something different, for a different alternative. And that's why we're getting such a push now for the control and the censorship of social media. And they're trying to present it as if the demand is coming from the masses. We're all, every day now, there's a fresh story about some tragedy, some child who saw an image she shouldn't, someone who was groomed, someone who committed suicide. Heart-wrenching stories of horrible things that happen to people through their exposure to the bad side of social media. But the aim is not to protect the lives of the innocent. The aim is to crush the truth. The aim is to make it look as if we, for our own preservation, have asked them to police social media for us. And who are the targets going to be? The targets are going to be us, and don't fall for it. Absolutely do not fall for the campaign of please police social media because there's paedophiles on it or there's bullies on it or any of the rest of it. It's about silencing the alternative. But they are scared. They are very scared by the rise, the ability now. What did George say? Ignorance now is self-inflicted. Ignorance used to be blanket because we just weren't told anything. Now, with the internet, if you want to find out, you can. If you want to find out, you can, and you have to decide not to stay ignorant. And that's really important. These duopolies, these Tweedledum and Tweedledee situations all over the world, they are under threat. And our voice is starting to come through, and so we have to defend that voice, we have to build that voice, but we have to build not only a media, but an organisation that backs us up, backs up our power against this state machine. I just want to come back on one thing someone said earlier. It was about imperialism. I think everybody in this room, however they label themselves, should go home and read Lenin's book on imperialism. It's really short. It was written 100 years ago. You will not find a sentence in there that you disagree with. And there's one sentence I want to say to you. He said, imperialism doesn't seek democracy, it seeks domination. Does that or does that not describe the world that you see today?
Right, right, folks. The only thing left now is for a performance by Mike Barson for our Pianist with Madness and his brother Ben and Yasmin. So could we have Yasmin and Ben up now for the final part of tonight to give a musical performance? Can I just thank you all for coming? Can I thank RT for live streaming? And I thank all the speakers that have given wonderful speeches. Also, I have to apologise earlier for using the... I was very passionate. I used words in a church that perhaps I shouldn't have, but I don't think God would have really minded.
No, I missed that.
So Right. Just one other thing. Thank you all for coming and for paying the £8. The £8 goes towards Assange campaigns and others that are fighting for Julian Assange. So thank you.